Hi, welcome to Inside Learning Technology, Episode 1, The Maiden Voyage.
Hello, and welcome to the first episode of Inside Learning Technology.
Hi, this is so exciting, Ali. Good to be here. We've just spent half an hour getting it all ready. You say hello, and I'm sitting in dumbfounded silence, going, "Oh, what do I say?"
I know it's been a real struggle to get to this point, but I'm really glad we're finally here and things are finally working. So it's great news in this front. So
there is an irony, Ali, that it's Inside Learning Technology, and what's held us back is getting the technology to work.
It's extremely ironic. I'm sure there's plenty of other people out there that are sitting, kicking themselves, saying, "Oh, we could have done this in half the time." But well, we're here now, and it works. So nothing's getting unplugged for the next month until I know that I can plug it in and take it out again and get it all to speak to each other all at the same time. So it's fantastic news.
Exactly. Yeah, I've always recommended when you finally get your podcast set up going, you know, it's worth taking photographs of it, or, you know, writing down notes of which lead goes where. And actually, you know, it would encourage people to run podcasts. It's a great thing, you know. It's the democratization of ideas in the web, isn't it? You know, it's an audio blog, but it's not easy. Skype is great. It's connecting us even though we're in different places, but getting your computer to record Skype and record yourself at the same time is surprisingly difficult, and I think a lot of people are put off and taken by surprise with that.
Well, most definitely, yeah, and I think we're both. I'm a perfect example of that, in the sense that you think that's fine, I'll just get Skype to work, but if you've never used the recording program before, then it's definitely a challenge to get everything to properly speak to one another. But once you've got it, no unplugging it, and there's no stopping you.
Yeah, and again, just not to be podcast bores, but to anyone listening again might still be bewildered. One of the little known facts about recording Skype that makes this difficult is that when you Skype someone, you don't actually get your own voice in the feed. And people don't realise that, so you can't just record the output of Skype because your voice is missing from it. So you have to find some way of mixing your own voice with the output of Skype, and that's not something that Windows or even Mac, for that matter, just automatically will do for you. You need to use some kind of a sound card or some sort of software that does it for you. And once you start using software, you're never absolutely sure whether it's working or not.
No, exactly. And so I think to tell everyone else to share a detail that we have four backups running tonight, just to make sure that it definitely works, because I've got Cubase running and a backup recorder. Matthew, you've got the same as well. So it just illustrates that to make sure you actually get a chat and you're able to hold on to it, then you've got to have it maybe four or five times over.
Yeah, belt and braces. Anyway, so we're ready for a podcast to break out right enough now.
We are, most definitely. Most definitely for the maiden voyage. Is that a bad luck at this time?
I've no idea. Yeah, certainly at the time of celebrating anniversaries of the Titanic going down, maybe not the right image, but... Anyway, we'll be talking about other more cheerful anniversaries tonight. Ali, give us some sort of idea what we're going to be talking about on the cast. It's going to be your baby, so lay out the land for us here.
Well, what I thought I'd do, first of all, before we go into talking about tonight, I thought I'd just kind of set out my wish list, if you like, for topics over the next few weeks. I'm hoping to do a special episode on games-based learning. So we're going to touch on that a little bit tonight. Particularly interesting in games-based learning is there seems to be more and more research being done into the benefits of games-based learning, and in particular its application in early years. So I'm very interested to explore that a little bit more, and hopefully line up some guests expert guests to be able to come and talk to us about that. Also hoping to look a little bit about emerging technologies, particularly with the use of GPS and other things in schools and in education as well. Mm-hmm. So thoroughly looking forward to getting that all started and involved. And finally, just keeping up with the development of new technology as it comes along. So I can't really plan any new technology that is coming, but the interesting one being the very slow and gradual release of the Raspberry Pi as it eventually comes to market. I understand there's a few people now have got one. I'm still waiting for mine. Are you still waiting for yours, Matthew?
I haven't ordered it. I don't know what the hell I'm going to do with it. I know I want one, but I can't really justify why I want it.
Well, see, I'm in the situation. I'm the same as you, but I just want it for a toy, to be honest. Maybe we can podcast off a Raspberry Pi one. We can see if that works.
So the whole the whole raison d'être of the podcast then is just to help people keep up to date with tech, and as a secondary thing really, and how that might impact classes. The trouble with tech is we never know exactly how it will, so there's going to be a bit of speculation there.
Exactly, yeah, and I think the biggest thing as well is we're trying to do as much as we can to talk about what is going on, but I think at the end of the day it would be nice to get other people's input as to what they're using and what they're enthusiastic about, and that way then we can have operate far more of a sharing culture. Yeah. I think from that then it'll be far easier for us to see where actual developments are actually working. So what may work with us up in a rural area may not be so applicable in an inner city area or even just anywhere else in the country.
Sure.
So it'll be nice to hear other people's experiences as well, and feel free to get in touch. We're more than happy to hear people's contribution to this.
Fantastic. And being an Inside Learning podcast, I guess it's always worth reminding people that it's very much about future schooling. We're all about the treasure within. The idea about schooling for what young people are going to face when they're older and when they leave, rather than just what makes us comfortable now.
Yeah, exactly. And at the end of the day, as I keep telling everybody else, it's not about the technology today, it's going to be the technology tomorrow. That's the bit you can never plan for, but you need to be ready for and able to adapt and then take it forward as well.
So what's our first item then, talking about technology tomorrow? Are you going to take us backwards in time, perhaps?
I was going to take you backwards in time, yes. very interesting you say that, Matthew. Seamless link there. It was interesting this week that we had the 30th anniversary of the ZX Spectrum, I think ironically on its anniversary, as things start to move forward again, we seem to be almost taking a step back that direction to start looking at the we were just talking about the Raspberry Pi and the programming, as much of the ZX Spectrum was designed and based upon. And when it was released, obviously it was profound for at the time its high resolution graphics and sound, as the Raspberry Pi is for a very not quite the same price, but it was as with the HD graphics and not necessarily the best sound, but for the price it certainly is. It certainly offers something that kind of basis of programming for the user as well. Now, without giving away too much about your age here, Matthew, did you ever own a ZX Spectrum?
Actually, I didn't. No, oh. there's a wee bit of a confession there. Actually, I played with the Spectrum a lot because my girlfriend at the time, her little brother had a Spectrum, and I'm afraid if young Colin is listening now to this at any point, I'm sorry, Colin. When you went to bed, I'd sit and play with your Spectrum late at night. My favourite game was Fighter Pilot, which had massively exciting 3D graphics, which, as I recall, was just a green screen that was supposed to be ground, with the occasional sort of blocky-looking runway that would appear, It was just, graphically, with the benefit of hindsight now, very limited, shockingly poor. But at the time, I thought it was really exciting, and I really enjoyed playing it. But the confession isn't just that. It's that instead of doing something sensible like buying a Spectrum, I bought a second-hand computer at the time, which, to be fair, I learned how to do basic programming on. It was the Mattel Aquarius. Yes, you may well think to yourself, what the hell was that? You need to look this one up in Wikipedia, guys. It was a damp squib. It was actually the same processor as the Spectrum. It was a Z80 processor. And it had the same kind of potential, but frankly, it never really got off the ground. It had little cartridges as an option, get around the problem of loading from cassette tapes, which is what people were doing with the Spectrum at the time. To get your programs in. I don't know if any younger people are listening now and don't really recall this, but you used to have to connect an audio input from a cassette player, and the cassette would actually play modem, you know, sort of style bleeps, which would be the ones and zeros of the code to actually load up your programs. And it was hit and miss. You had to get the volume control just right, or sometimes the program just wouldn't load or be corrupted. It was really exciting, I have to say, Ali. It just felt like you were at the cutting edge. It was great.
Oh no, it sounds wonderfully exciting. So just we were talking about cutting edge graphics there. Going completely off on a tangent. I managed to get hold of a new toy this week. I managed to get hold of an LED projector, which is in itself doesn't sound very exciting, but I've never seen the kind of the definition of this projector and on the scale that it was able to offer to me on as well. I mean, I understand that you can get these 60-inch full HD 3D tellies and all the rest of it now, but it was just the sheer size that the screen was able to offer me, and the brightness and the clarity it was able to offer at a considerable distance. I think I had about a 10-foot screen, and it still looked full HD as near as made no difference. So it was just, while we're talking about graphics and moving forward there as well, it's interesting where other things are going with it, how far things have come along from almost audio coding, if you like, to full HD LED projectors.
Absolutely. I guess the big point for us, though, and Rory, I'm never quite sure how you pronounce it, Rory Kechlin-Jones, the BBC tech blogger, he wrote a piece a couple of weeks ago that was really interesting, saying that there was a wave of nostalgia among the 40-plus, and of course, I am indeed 45, I believe, so I must be slap bang in the middle of that nostalgic wave. And I also had a BBC Micro when I started teaching, which was the 6502 processor, generally reckoned not to be as good as the Z80, but a perfectly serviceable 8-bit processor. But the thing is, all of these machines, they all came with a programming guide. I think even this, I'm not certain that happened to the Spectrum, because as you know, I didn't have one myself. But I think it did. I think the culture then was that you were lucky if you got some games on cassette or cartridge or whatever it would be. But basically, you were also buying these things with the expectation that you would learn how to do a bit of basic coding. And it literally was basic. You know, was it beginner's all-purpose symbolic instruction code? Is that what it stood for? And, you know, lots of us dutifully went through the little guidebooks that would gradually teach you how to print your name and have it say hello, and then print it at different places in the screen, and then make sprites that would move around the screen, you know. And I guess that's one of the big differences. You know, how many people buy a new computer now and have it come with any expectation that you'll interact with anything in it other than the packages and the software?
Yeah, that's very true, actually. And there's always the, you get the...
We dropped connection there for a moment, Ali.
I do.
Yeah, so don't worry about it. Just in case listeners are thinking, why was there a silence there? It definitely chopped up and dropped.
This is part of my conspiracy theory. I've got a conspiracy theory at the moment of what's going on. There's a huge military exercise taking place off the coast of Stornoway at the moment. A joint warrior, and I've noticed there's been a distinct drop in bandwidth, a distinct drop in mobile phone signal, a distinct drop in all of my electronic devices. Just seem to all just crash any opportunity at the moment. So. It's all part of my conspiracy theory.
Well, I thought you were mad, but when you told me this, I suddenly realised that my GPS, when my cycling route recording dropped out for half the route on Sunday, so maybe there is something in this. Were GPS jamming on Sunday. Who knows?
It's very true. It's very, very true. All this, I'm profound in truth here. There's truth in my madness, I'm telling you.
But anyway, let's climb out of this rat hole again and back to the nostalgia of the Spectrum. So that brings us up to date, doesn't it? Because the thing that Kechlin-Jones was writing about was that, you know, all of that's gone. You just buy machines now and they do everything for you. You don't have to know anything about the programming or the innards. That's why the Raspberry Pi is so exciting. You might want to just say something about it, because it is possible that some of our listeners may have been living in a hermitage somewhere and don't know anything about the Raspberry Pi.
Yeah, well, with the Raspberry Pi basically is a credit card sized computer that runs a Linux partition on it. It's designed to be a very, very basic computer, only costing about just over £30 for the whole package. And all you need to run the computer is you need a screen. It can be just a television screen or any VGA screen as well. And and then a keyboard and a mouse, and you can really do pretty much any, not pretty much, sorry, you can do most things that a normal computer can do. You can browse the web, you can do all these other things. And also on the sidelines, then you can start writing your own basic little bits of programming as well. One of the one of the programs that the Raspberry Pi is installed with as a default is Scratch. Scratch was developed by MIT in the States as a very basic programming tool where you can just quite simply program a character to do whatever you like. You can draw a track on a screen and then get the character to walk around the screen. You can also then start to build it up to make it into levels of computer game as well. Really goes far, as little as far as you like. Now, I'm not going to go into the Scratch too much because I'm hoping to cover that a bit more when we talk a bit more about games-based learning. Because I know that Scratch is being used in secondary schools at the moment as an introduction to programming, and then taking that on to then starting to design the children's own computer games through using that. So it's a very exciting time for programming and for moving forward as well. And because of there is so much potential, and it's just making sure that people interact with it at all levels as well. So it could be some quite exciting things coming up, certainly within that. Now I'm going to move on a little bit.
Can I ask you one thing before you move on?
Yes.
What languages does the Raspberry Pi ship with? You know, what can you do with it when you don't have one? I guess that's not a fair question, but does it have, you know, some languages built in? Is there, you know, is there something that you can code on?
It is, yes, but I can't remember entirely off the top of my head which ones it does come in, and we would need to check. I've got too many languages running around in my head at the moment. We're just in my classroom. We're just doing a topic on the Olympic Games. I've been learning a little bit of Mandarin today, so I'm getting coding languages and real languages really mixed up at the moment. So you're going to have to excuse me for not knowing that. But I'll find out for the next time we're on, and I'll certainly let everybody know then. So I'm going to move on.
Okay.
I'm going to move forward a little bit as well. I'm going to move forward to talk about Matthew and I were discussing earlier on the other day about the fact that Google has announced now that they are making available up to 16 terabytes online and part of their cloud storage for folk to use and store their files in it. Now, the small print of it is that 16 terabytes will cost you the best part of $700-$800 a month. So it comes at a considerable cost, but it's quite exciting and encouraging, the fact now that they're offering such a large amount of storage online. It used to be, you can remember the time where a 1 gigabyte USB pen drive was very exciting. I've never seen something as big as that. But I know that on the Gadget Show on Monday, as part of their prize fund, they had a 256 gigabyte USB drive. And it's very exciting to see how these tiny little things are growing more and more and more and more as technology gets smaller and as things get far more developed as well.
256 gigabyte USB drive, wow. What did that? They didn't say the price, did they?
No, it was part of their 40 grand prize fund, so I can only presume it's probably about £1,000 worth of that.
Yeah.
But it's just amazing how quickly it's going forward. But then if to offer a bit of practical advice and to completely shoot myself in the foot for ever working for Google as well, if you are thinking about spending the $800 a month to pay for 16 terabytes worth of hard drive, you can quite easily buy 16 terabyte hard drives for considerably less than that, and they will last you a heck of a lot longer as well. So don't go all rushing and buying 16 terabytes of online cloud storage space. Yep. At this moment in time, you don't think you quite need it.
No, but they are giving, 7 gigabytes free?
Yes. Yes. First 5 gigabyte comes free, and then it goes as 25, 100, a terabyte, and then 16 terabytes. So they're incremental sizes as well. Right. I think it's probably part of Google's constant fight with Microsoft as to who's offering the most for the price as well.
This is really interesting, isn't it? Because there's a whole lot of stuff going on. You know, first of all, there's a debate online about whether this is going to put companies like Dropbox out of business, because Dropbox have been, you know, quietly getting a lot of heart share, if you like. You know,
sorry, Matthew, we just dropped out there again.
Oh, sorry. Okay, have you got me again? This is your exercise again. Obviously, the hello, Ali.
Yeah, I've got you again now, yeah.
Oh, that was a long pause there. Okay, right, anyway. Yeah, there's a kind of whole thing about companies like Dropbox that maybe can't compete with, you know, the big guns like Microsoft and Google. Microsoft are offering a similar thing, aren't they, with their SkyDrive? You know, I think it's a certain amount free. I think maybe they're seven, maybe that's where I get that from, free, and you can pay for increased amounts. But in terms of use in education, this throws up big challenges for us, because you or I might have a Dropbox account, or we might have a Google storage account, but you can't access these routinely in school networks. So in terms of transferring files between home and school or the business, it may well be that you're not allowed to access them because they don't meet the secure storage regulations UK public sector organisations are bound by.
Yeah, I know, and it's something that I think generally needs to be looked at, because it's becoming far more of a situation where you're transferring documents between school and home, or even the home and the office as well. And at the moment, the only feasible way to do it is to email them to yourself and then pick them up from your email at home, because you can't. There's obviously very strict policies on using USB pens or USB pen drives, anything like that. And the only way to do it is to email the document to yourself. But if you're sending big presentation files or PowerPoint files or anything like that, then it clogs. One file just completely fills your inbox. And until you're home, you're not receiving any other mail, because your mass is over your storage limit as well.
Yeah, yeah. I suppose different authorities will have different storage limits, so that might not be the main problem. But there's no doubt these are becoming common, for people in the general digital world to keep their files in a Dropbox, photo files, personal files, even some work files. People blend these things, and it's that blended nature, I think, that ICT departments just don't like, because they don't want that stuff, with its potential virus payloads clogging up their system. But more importantly to them, they don't want you uploading a class list with the personal information of children, and having that be hacked, because it doesn't make the same security standards that that they have. I guess an argument I always have about that, though, is that it's fair enough to say, okay, we're banning their use on that basis, but a lot of people are just going to work around it and find ways of loading the same information onto USB drives, as you say, and they're a lot easier to have drop out your pocket on the way home or to lose than perhaps it's more likely that would happen than someone's going to hack into your your Google SkyDrive or your Microsoft SkyDrive.
Yeah, no, I can totally agree with you there. And as you're saying, if you've got a USB pen or anything like that, then you hear of the MI6 spies leaving laptops on the trains and all these other things. Got civil servants doing the same things with millions of people's information on it.
Yeah.
Okay, a class list with 26 children's names on it, it's not the same as 5 million people's credit card details. But at the end of the day, we're still having to keep things secure. And I totally agree with you. It's far easier to keep things secure online than it is to keep things secure that you can leave on the train or you can leave in your car, or anyone can really gain access to. At least the fact that by having them online, then there is some sort of security encryption in place already that can keep it relatively safe. I'm not saying entirely safe, but relatively safe.
Yeah, oh, I totally agree. Another problem is that a lot of people are users of, for example, Microsoft 365, and the Office tools online. I believe that that's entirely designed from the ground up to integrate with their SkyDrive solution. So, not allowing people access to that could be highly limiting in terms of how they integrate their you know, their personal, you know, office use and, you know, word processing and stuff with time at work. You know, we seem to assume that there's almost a kind of a firewall, if you forgive the digital image there, between people's personal working style and the way they you know, they work in their workplace. But I think increasingly that's going to become blended, and certainly Microsoft and Google make it easier and easier to blend them. And I just think this is a pressure that's going to build and build. And eventually we're going to have a better solution, or else we're simply not taking advantage of these tools.
Almost definitely, yeah. And just what you're talking about, the SkyDrive solution, I've got a Hotmail email address, and I was baffled to see that I went on and checked that what files of mine had been stored online. And what had been happening is any attachment that had been sent had been automatically uploaded to my SkyDrive, which I was just shocked by, because I mean, there's some stuff that I get sent a whole load of papers for an organization I'm a chairman in, and it's, I mean, I don't want some of the, quite a lot of them, I do not want them to be uploaded on them, because they're short term files I want to look at, then delete, get rid of them, and not if they're being backed up on a SkyDrive somewhere. I was able to find minutes from 2 or 3 years ago that no idea even existed.
Actually, this whole thing about cloud storage has its dark side, because the companies that are providing this are almost trying to be too clever. You know, I came across this. I'm an Android phone user, and if you use an Android phone or tablet, I think the default in it is that if you take photographs with the device, you know, like your camera phone, then it automatically backs up to a Google storage space. I don't know, you know, it's not a Google, you know, SkyDrive kind of a thing. I think it's just something they must allocate to your account if you're a Google Android user. Now, I didn't know this was happening. I should have done, actually, because now that I think, I tried a Google Plus account at some point recently, and I noticed that my photos, when I took them on the camera phone, gave me the option, you know, to upload them automatically to Google Plus. And I think I'd said, no, don't make that a default. But I was trying out a tablet recently with work. It was an Android Asus Transformer tablet. And eventually I gave in trying to use it and asked permission of the people that had loaned me it. I said, can I just sign in, you know, with my Google Android sign-in, because I couldn't really use any of the apps that I know on it, and I couldn't really test it properly, you know, because it was very limited. These things are so much about your online account. Anyway, to my shock, I signed in with my account on my home Wi-Fi and suddenly realised all of my photographs were on it. So even though I'd never used that device to take photographs, you know, all 200 photographs of various descriptions that I had were suddenly on this device I was testing for work. So there are real dangers there to this automatic cloud storage. Yeah, I mean, it's not as inappropriate, but still, you know, it could go badly wrong, couldn't it?
Exactly, and it's talking. There's another article this week, or that they reckon that of one in ten hard drives that are thrown away are blank, and the other 9 out of 10 have still got some sort of personal information stored on them.
Yeah,
and I think it was a BBC program. I can't remember what it was called, but they reckon the only way to actually properly confirm that nobody can glean the data off a hard drive is to pretty much drive it off the truck and then melt it.
Yeah, well, I haven't driven a truck over my hard drives. When I've thrown out hard drives in the past, not that I've thrown them all out, I still have a little hoard of them, thinking I might, you know, someday need to, you know, find some backup of a file or whatever. But I have thrown out a few, and I always take a hammer to them and just literally, you know, dent in the top so that the actual physical drive can't be turning easily anymore. And that I reckon is probably secure enough.
Yeah, exactly. But then you just don't know, do you? If somebody wants to get it, then they'll go out of their way to try.
I take the view, if someone's keen enough to take my battered hard drive apart and you know, get data off it, they'll be able to hack into my system, I think, a lot easier than that. I don't think they'll need to hang around my bins for old hard drives.
exactly. Just while you're talking about the Android tablet there, Matthew, and you know, you and I were having a discussion earlier on this week about the why Android tablets haven't taken off the same way as the iPad has. Do you have any thoughts on why that is?
Do you know, it's a really difficult question. I don't. I mean, one of the obvious thoughts is that the iPad is a beautiful device. You know, it's a physically beautiful device because it's had the Apple magic, you know, design dust blown on it. And, you know, that you can't take that away from Apple. They do make a beautiful tablet. The problem probably with the Android tablets is twofold. The ones that are cheap enough to undercut the iPad tend not to be so great. The screens aren't so responsive, or you know, a lot of them come out with a set of limitations in the software, so that you couldn't just automatically access the Google App Store. You know, so there was various things that weren't quite as good, even though some of them were super bargain prices. You know, or the screens weren't as bright, or the resolution of the screen wasn't as good. And the problem is where you get an Android tablet that is high quality, like this one I've been talking about, which is probably one of the more successful ones, the Asus e-Transformer. It's one that you can clip on and off a keyboard. For it's a high quality device. It feels good in the hand. It's beautifully made. The screen is very impressive. It's a really, you know, everyone that's looked at this one, which is about 6 months old now actually, I'll say beautiful for photos, real pin sharpness on it. But the trouble is, it doesn't undercut the iPad. It's the same kind of price. So if you're going out to get a device, do you go for the relatively untested Android tablets? I mean, you know, Android is super established in the phone. I don't think anyone should be afraid of using an Android phone. It's, you know, it's massively successful now. I believe the Galaxy brand, isn't it? The Samsung Galaxy phones are now the biggest selling smartphones in the world, even over, you know, iPhones or anything. You know, you're in safe ground there now. But the tablets are a bit untested, so if it's going to be more or less the same price to get an Android tablet or an iPad, I think people probably are quite wise to default to the iPad that they know there's lots of apps and lots of support for.
No, I think you're quite right. It's just interesting there because I'm an iPhone user myself, and I've been, at the moment, I've been coming more and more frustrated because I was, part of my conspiracy theory, obviously, but I'm finding at the moment I've been trying to use apps and they just keep crashing. And it's almost consistently, every single one, no matter what one I use, and I took everything off it, I've restored the software, and then I've gradually put things back on it again. With the ones that I know that work, that don't have any bugs or anything else that might affect the phone in it, but it's still just it's not giving the experience I want to, and I'm struggling to use the functionality that it offers me. And I've been more and more pulled towards the Galaxy brand because
that's the 5.3-inch screen, isn't it?
Yeah, it looks
kind
fantastic.
Of tablet come phone or phone come tablet.
Yeah, I'm coming to replace my phone in August. That's what's highest in favor with me at the moment. It looks just fantastic.
Have you held one in your hand?
I haven't. No, I need to take a trip.
You might get a wee shock. My girlfriend's been kind of pushing the idea with me. You know, she knows I'm due a new phone. I'm due an update now, and I'm waiting to see what this Galaxy S3 is going to be like. You know, because I'd like a new one, but I do want one that you can put a micro SD card in. Because I like to carry a lot of music on my phone, and I've got a 32 gig card in the Android phone I've got at the moment. I don't want to go to a new phone, no matter how super it is, if it actually means I'm cutting down my memory, you know, and that's one of the things that's really important to me. But the Galaxy Note would give me what I wanted, you know, and I really fancy that writing on the screen thing as an occasional option. It looks great. But see, when you actually lift it up in the shop, you know, the show model, it's huge. You have got big paws, but I can only just wrap my hands around it and no more. Putting it to your ear would be a comical experience. So look at it before you don't order that one online, Ali. Go and play with it.
No, I think definitely no. That's definitely a trip to Glasgow day to go and play in the shops.
But I'll tell you what. To put that one in the hands of our kids, I think is a genuinely exciting prospect, because you know the iPad or the Android tablet debate probably wouldn't be so important there. You know, if you could equip all the kids in your class, you know, if they were going to have a smartphone anyway with something like a Galaxy Note, that's a genuinely good note-taking device. You know, they could be taking photographs and storing them on, you know, Evernote of notes that you've been taking or projects you've been working on. They could be taking notes directly with the wee pen and the handwriting recognition. I think it's a really good form factor. Probably for younger kids, you know, you could probably go, you know, an inch or two smaller and it would still be a good phone, you know, maybe one of the 4-inch screens that are becoming popular. And while I'm, you know, kind of on a roll about this, I worry about the iPhone in this regard. As you know, I don't have an iPhone now. I had the iPhone 3GS for 18 months beforehand, and I was very happy with it. It was a good device, you know. But I get really frustrated with the size. Smartphones are drifting to bigger sizes now. The screens are bigger, and they get more real estate to use them as ebook readers or to just to get more of the browser on screen. The iPhone seems to have trapped itself in that. Is it 3.7 inch screen?
Yeah, something like that. I think it's 3.78. I think, but it's I know what you mean. It's kind of cramped.
Aye, and the thing that made it the winning device, apart from the fact that it deservedly was the first device that was a really usable smartphone, is that it's got that ecosystem that you can slot it into music players and stuff docks. And if they were to go for a bigger screen, maybe it wouldn't fit those things anymore. I wonder if they've trapped themselves with their own ecosystem.
Yeah, exactly, and then the kind of the knock on effect for the market as well, that if Apple do decide to change their device, then there's going to be a whole host of companies that are car companies and hi-fi companies as well that are going to have to then completely reconfigure all their designs to keep in line with the update of it. So then you then wonder about the cost and the implications for them afterwards, and they've almost become a victim of their own successes in some sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
We'll see what happens when iPhone 5 time comes around, which is...
When is that?
By current patterns, and that should be about the start about December time this year, roughly. That kind of fits in with the schedule, because the 4S was announced around about that time last year, and they generally tend to do one announcement on that per year.
Yeah.
So we'll wait and see what happens with that. That'll be something exciting on the horizon that certainly could be a topic nearer the time. But on that note,
okay,
I'm noticing we're running quite. We're drifting on, and we might as well start as we mean to go on, is trying to keep us close to 30 minutes or so we possibly can.
We're already over it.
I know. If we don't tell anyone, nobody
will
notice.
All right, okay.
So that's at 36 minutes anyway. But I think that's been a great start to this, and hopefully we'll keep going forward as well. Now, my next episode is going to be in 2 weeks' time. The content of which I'm going to keep closely guarded to my heart at the moment, because I've got two things that could possibly line up, and I'm waiting to see which one comes up first. So in about 2 weeks' time, hopefully on Monday this time, not on Thursday, on a Monday, then we'll be able to have the podcast be available to you. In the meantime, if you keep up with the blog on the Inside Learning website, if you click on the top link, there's a link to Inside Learning Technology there. Any announcements or news or developments in that will be all posted up onto there. All right.
Fantastic, Ali. Well, thank you for having me as your first guest. As you know, I'm going to be as close to the program as I possibly can. Listeners have probably got from this that I'm as much of a geek as as an educator. So I'll be happy to guest or even cover for you whenever you're stuck in the program, Ali. So people will be hearing a lot of me as well, I'm sure.
Yes, no, thank you very much, Matthew. And yes, we hope to have to see plenty of you as well for your contribution and for everything else too. And I'm sure we'll rope in other people as well. Maybe not so much Jay, because I think he struggles a bit with the old technology, but we'll see what happens.
That's a wee test to see if he listens to the programme, isn't it?
It is. And on that note, I know that Jay and I were for a little bit of personal plugging. We took part in some filming with the BBC last October, and it was aired Tuesday night on BBC Two. It's a programme called Our Food in the West of Scotland, and you can see if you can guess who Jay and I are. We're in the section about potatoes. So if anyone's feeling really, really geeky, then they can go and have a wee watch out. It's about 10 minutes into the program for about 6 minutes of the duration of it. And you can come and you can see us. And I think we wave hello. So there you go.
Can you share a link?
I can. We
is
can
it
put
on the
link.
iPlayer?
It is on the iPlayer, yeah. We'll put a link on the bottom of this so that people can really enjoy the experience.
That's fantastic. Well, that's okay. Great. Listen, it's been fabulous chatting with you tonight, and really looking forward to us developing a lot of thinking about technology and how it can affect classrooms. So thanks again, Ali, for having me tonight.
Yes, no problem. Thanks, Matthew. Thank you very much for coming on, and we'll see everyone very soon.
Okay.
Good night.
Good night, Ali.